From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the split in the Bush administration over Iran, regime change versus behavior change. We talk with journalist Laura Rosen. She's a national security correspondent for the Washington Monthly and a contributor to National Journal. Lots of fruits and vegetables lost their taste when they were bred to withstand long-distance shipping. We'll talk with Russ Parsons about how produce has changed for better and for worse, and how to select the tastiest fruits and vegetables. His latest book is How to Pick a Peach. And Kevin Whitehead reviews a posthumously released CD by saxophonist Michael Brecker. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In its policy toward Iran, the Bush administration has been split between advocates of regime change and behavior change, according to my guest Laura Rosen. She says those who want the U.S. military to overthrow President Ahmadinejad are losing. The pragmatists within the Bush administration, who want to change the Iranian regime's behavior through sanctions, international pressure, and incentives, are winning. Rosen is the national security correspondent for the Washington Monthly. She's a contributor to National Journal and a senior correspondent for the American Prospect. I asked her how she thinks the pragmatists have become more influential within the Bush administration.
Ascendant a few years ago were a group of people who believed that you couldn't really deal with this Iranian regime and that the way to deal with it was to change it the way they changed Iraq. The past year, you've seen the realization that the U.S. is overwhelmed with its occupation of Iraq, and you've seen the pragmatists who support trying to get this Iranian regime to change its behavior become more ascendant. And that group is led by Condoleezza Rice in the State Department, and they're trying to work now with the Europeans and the Russians and the Chinese to pressure Iran through economic sanctions to suspend its uranium enrichment and stop its support for these destabilizing groups.
You say that the regime change position within the Bush administration has lost a lot of its power. What are some of the signs that it's lost power?
One is the departure of officials from the Bush administration who had supported that position, such as John Bolton, who'd been the ambassador to the United Nations, several people from the Pentagon, Paul Wolfowitz, Douglas Feith, who had headed a policy shop that has several people who were brought in 2002, 2003 to work on Iran and subverting that regime. Cheney's office itself is now considered the main sort of last vestige of the people in the administration who are deeply skeptical that the U.S. is going to be able to get Iran to stop its nuclear program through diplomacy. And you've seen many reports in recent weeks that there's a kind of hot dispute between the Condi Rice group at the State Department and people in Cheney's office who are perhaps trying to sabotage her and wait their opportunity to seize control of the policy again.
You said that another sign that the hardliners on Iran have lost some of the power, some of the regime change advocates have lost some of their power, is that a group called the Iran-Syria Policy Operations Group was closed down. What was this group and who shut it down?
The lead person in the State Department doing the Iran nuclear issue is a undersecretary of state named Nick Burns. He's the guy who Rice sends to talk with the Europeans, the Russians, the Chinese about coming up with some united front to pressure Iran to change its behavior. And, you know, the past year he's been leading that effort. At the same time, there have been all sorts of media reports that there's this Iran-Syria Policy Operations Group that was coordinating between the different agencies of the U.S. government in an unusual way on action to kind of poke at Iran. And the group was little understood. Some of the people involved were clearly from the regime change school. I reported a year ago that there was a small Iranian directorate set up in the Pentagon with people who'd been at the Office of Special Plans during the run-up to the Iraq War. These people very much supported regime change in Iran, and they were participating in this Iran-Syria operations group. Junior Senator Robert Casey on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee was asking Burns about this in testimony a couple months back and got a written response back at the end of May from Burns saying, oh, by the way, that group has been shut down. So my understanding is that Burns had never liked the group. He felt that it was leading to a turf war and that people were going to too many meetings and nothing was getting done, and he wanted just to clean up the process.
Was Donald Rumsfeld one of the regime change people before he was forced out as Secretary of Defense?
I don't think I know that Rumsfeld was a regime changer on Iran so much as his department authorized a lot of unusual things on Iran, and it was primarily the Pentagon that was the center with moral support, perhaps, from Cheney's office for the regime change option. In particular, it was people in Feith's former policy shop that were most active on trying to explore unconventional options for overturning the Iranian regime. There were a couple officials who worked for Feith at the time who met with an old arms dealer from the Iran-Contra era named Manoucher Gorbanifar. They were authorized by the top levels of the Pentagon to go meet with Gorbanifar in Rome and in Paris. Gorbanifar was asking for $20 million from the U.S. government to, he said, implement a coup in Tehran. And Tenet, the former CIA director's, George Tenet's book describes, you know, the CIA learning about the Pentagon running around meeting with these Iranian oppositionists and not being really part of the channel, which is highly unusual. And I think it just speaks to 4 years ago how close we were to those people who wanted to change the regime in Iran, getting very close to the White House, getting close to the White House, authorizing, you know, contemplating that.
Mm-hmm. And what about the new Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates? Where does he stand on Iran? What's his strategy?
My understanding is that Gates is far more pragmatic and moderate. He's been part of this Iraq study group, or he had been until he was appointed defense secretary, that was strongly urging the Bush administration to talk with two of Iraq's, you know, Iraq's neighbors, including Syria and Iran, about trying to stabilize the country. He also last week made a point of saying that now that there are intelligence reports that Iranian weapons are turning up in the hands of their former enemies, the Taliban in Afghanistan, that still the U.S. didn't have evidence that it was the Iranian government per se arming the Taliban. So he's definitely made efforts to make public statements that seem to show an effort to moderate the policy.
Now, in May, the U.S. had warships doing drills, military drills, right off the coast of Iran. How do you read that?
I think the U.S. decided in December that they were going to seriously ramp up their effort to show Iran that we were tough, the U.S. was tough, despite the difficulties for the U.S. in Iraq. And so, you know, you saw Bush in January make this very aggressive statement about sending defensive missiles to Sunni allies in the Gulf. We were going to be sending warships there. He had the next day the U.S. Detained several Iranians at an Iranian office in the Kurdish city of Erbil. Those people are still being detained. The U.S. let it be leaked to the New York Times and the Washington Post that Bush had authorized killing Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps people acting in Iraq. So I think the U.S. has been trying to increase its leverage with Iran, actually in the hopes of being able to talk with Iran. I think that it's actually they're trying to look tougher and let Iran know that we're not a paper, you know, the U.S. is not a paper tiger as it tries to seek a diplomatic solution to the crisis.
My guest is Laura Rosen, national security correspondent for The Washington Monthly and a contributor to National Journal. We'll talk more about the Bush administration and Iran after a break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. If you're just joining us, my guest is Laura Rosen. We're talking about Iran and the Bush administration's plans for Iran and the split within the Bush administration versus regime change in Iran or just trying to change the behavior of the regime in Iran. Rosen is the national security correspondent for Washington Monthly and is a contributor to National Journal. We have been talking about the advocates of regime change in Iran, and you say that they have considerably less power in the Bush administration than they did before. And you say that Condoleezza Rice is now a strong advocate for behavior change in Iran. What's her strategy?
Her strategy is essentially an indirect one of getting the rest of the world as much as possible to join an alliance, a U.S.-led alliance, to pressure Iran with all sorts of sanctions and diplomatic means, plus carrots, the offer that if Iran agrees to this, they'll get all sorts of good things, for Iran to change its behavior. That's her approach. And it's an approach that actually the U.S. succeeded at with North Korea just a few months ago. So I think there's a lot of pessimism inside the U.S. government. They're not seeing the Iranian regime's behavior change. They say that their lives are preoccupied with evidence that Iran is supporting insurgents killing coalition forces in Iraq and Afghanistan. But they are trying now to get a new round, a third round of international sanctions against Iran that may be more meaningful in the hopes that that would make the difference, that, you know, if they make the top leaders of the regime hurt enough, that they could get, you know, them to finally start thinking about changing their behavior.
Condoleezza Rice's deputy Nicholas Burns is the main State Department point person on Iran. He worked in the Clinton administration. He was Clinton's ambassador to Greece, and he was a spokesperson for the State Department under Madeleine Albright. Is he a surprise choice for the Bush administration?
No, I mean, actually, there's several people who are taking sort of key positions, especially in the second-term State Department, who are not ideologues, who are career diplomats and professionals. Chris Hill is the diplomat who just won the agreement with North Korea a couple months back, is someone who served as an ambassador for Clinton to Macedonia and Poland. And you see other career appointments of people who are not ideologues or controversial choices, like John Bolton, who's also been left the administration.
So what has Nicholas Burns' approach been to working with allies in creating carrots and sticks for Iran?
So Burns has led the process of getting UN International Security Council resolutions. They have a Chapter 7 resolution on Iran, which means that, you know, the Security Council decided that Iran was in breach of its agreement to the International Atomic Energy Association on its nuclear program and not in compliance. And they've managed to actually get two rounds of sanctions through the UN Security Council. They're just not very meaningful sanctions. And it's somewhat voluntary what countries decide to do. So you've seen Treasury Department officials running around, even to international banks, saying, this is not a good thing for your shareholders, for you all to be financing various energy projects in Iran. So they're trying to work through all sorts of ways of trying to get major international companies and countries to invest less in Iran. Russia sells weapons still to Iran. China does a lot of energy investment in Iran. So that's the challenge.
Now, you write that there's a second track of U.S. policy toward Iran, promoting democracy over the long haul. Now, does this mean, like, covert actions?
No, I actually don't think it means covert actions. I think that last year, largely because there was pressure coming from especially conservatives in Congress, Rice made a big high-profile announcement that the U.S. was going to be asking for $77 million from Congress to promote democracy in Iran. One thing I think she was trying to do at the time was co-opt some of the people who want to do regime change by doing some things that look a little bit like the U.S. is supporting regime change, when in fact the policy was moving very much towards, you know, traditional coercive diplomacy, tough diplomacy. But this program ultimately raised $66 million from Congress. I think about $50 million of that went to support U.S. government-funded broadcasting on Iran and Farsi language programming. And probably only 20 million plus went to support actual promoting civil society and democracy in Iran. And most of that money, my understanding is, went through two U.S. foundations and human rights groups that have expanded Iran programs. It's been reported that Freedom House and Human Rights Watch, I think Amnesty International, and the National Endowment of Democracy, IRI, the International Republican and National Democratic Institutes also are having expanded Iran programs. So very little of the money, as far as I can tell from my reporting, is actually going to anyone in Iran. But the problem is that the Iranian regime is already quite paranoid and quite brutal. It doesn't need too much excuse to arrest dissidents and students, women activists, human rights activists. And lots of U.S. talk about this democracy promotion program has led to really an incredibly serious crackdown in Iran that the Washington Post recently described as the worst in, since the revolution of 1979. And you talk to people at the State Department and you're like, is this worth it? You're not really getting that much democracy and civil society promotion from the money. And they say, kind of damned if we do, damned if we don't, that this is a real reflection of U.S. values to promote civil society. It is a very brutal regime. They don't accept that the U.S. program is what's leading to this tremendous crackdown. But it's clear that the Iranian government is using that program as an excuse to arrest, in particular recently, several Iranian Americans who are indirectly or directly associated with various think tanks that are suspected of having U.S., U.S. government funding. Although all signs are that these people have nothing to do with any plans for a velvet revolution in Iran.
Now, you described Cheney as one of the regime change hawks left in the administration. In mid-May, he was on board the USS John Stennis, which is an aircraft carrier that's now stationed in the Gulf. And from the Stennis, he said, "We'll stand with others to prevent Iran from gaining nuclear weapons and dominating this region." Now, when Cheney says that, it's hard to know how to interpret it, since, as you say, he's really, one of the hawks who favors regime change in Iran. So how did you interpret it?
I interpreted it as, Cheney being a sort of unapologetic, hawk on Iran, who's not really very easily able to be controlled by the Bush administration. And I think that, one senses that Condoleezza Rice, as the Secretary of State, is always trying to make whatever Cheney had just recently said sound like it's all part of the same policy that she's leading, and that, that she sort of lets him say what he wants to say as long as the president is listening to her and letting her sort of take the lead on this policy. But there's no question that there are internal disputes still within the administration about, ultimately whether they're going to be able to finish their term without having taken military action on Iran. At this point, it's fairly clear from U.S. government sources that the U.S. is not going to pursue regime change in Iran, but there is a sense that 10 or 12 months from now, as the U.S. starts to shift its posture in Iraq, if they are not seeing Iran agree to suspend its uranium enrichment and suspend its sort of destabilization that it's accused of doing in Iraq and Afghanistan and Lebanon and now Gaza, that those who believe the U.S. has to do a military confrontation on Iran before the Bush administration leaves office may again have a window of opportunity.
Are you saying that even though regime change might not be the immediate goal, there might be an airstrike against Iran to
Yes.
prevent it from getting nuclear weapons, like maybe an airstrike against one of its nuclear facilities?
Yes, exactly. I've heard, that would be the Navy's job. The goal would not be regime change. It would be, strikes on Bushehr and Natanz, and that it would be limited to the goal of trying to degrade Iran's nuclear capability, not to try to overthrow the regime.
What are some of the consequences an airstrike like that might have?
There's so many national security experts who think it would be a disaster, that it wouldn't actually prevent Iran from very long from being able to produce nuclear weapons, that Iran would almost certainly retaliate, and that it has the capability to work through groups like Hezbollah to strike, U.S. troops in Iraq, U.S. allies in the region. So there are a lot of people who think it's a disaster. That said, there are some people who believe that even a democratic administration could find itself at some point in the future committed to not letting Iran get nuclear weapons, having to confront the same choice. And there's some talk that some people may be able to prevail upon Bush, that he's the only person who can do this. He's not running again. Cheney's not running again. That, Iran poses a existential threat to Israel, and Iran with nuclear weapons is a threat to the U.S. national security interests and to that of our allies. And if this administration or the next is not able to persuade Iran to suspend its program, I do think it's likely in the next few years that there will be a confrontation. I don't think, as in North Korea, that they will allow Iran to get nuclear weapons if they can stop it.
Well, Laura Rosen, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Laura Rosen is national security correspondent for The Washington Monthly and a contributor to National Journal. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of The Histories of Herodotus, in stores and online at bn.com. And from Fox Searchlight, presenting Waitress, an uplifting comedy by Adrian Shelley about a small-town girl with big dreams, now playing in select theaters. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, how produce has changed for better and worse, and how to select the tastiest fruits and vegetables. We talk with Russ Parsons, author of How to Pick a Peach, and jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Pilgrimage, the posthumously released album from saxophonist Michael Brecker. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's so discouraging when you pick out a beautiful-looking peach or apple that turns out to be tasteless. The new book, How to Pick a Peach, by my guest Russ Parsons, explains how breeders have often sacrificed taste in order to develop fruits and vegetables that can withstand the long journey from the farm to the supermarket. Parsons' book also offers advice on selecting, storing, and preparing fruits and vegetables. He's a food and wine columnist for the LA Times. Russ Parsons, welcome back to Fresh Air. So what do you think is the fruit or vegetable that has suffered the most lately as a result of being bred to withstand long-distance shipping? Let's eliminate the tomato, because we have sung the woes of the tomato for many years now. So come up with a different answer.
Oh, besides, I can't do tomatoes? Well, I'd say probably right off the top of my head, I would say strawberries. Because the strawberry in its natural state is a very, very fragile piece of fruit. But as a fragile piece of fruit, especially when it's ripe, you can't take it in your truck very far. And so in trying to improve the strawberry so that it could be shipped to New York and Philadelphia and Florida, the plant breeders have made it more and more resilient to the point now where, you know, you've got strawberries that when you try and crush them with a fork, it'll actually bend the fork. You know, they're defensive strawberries. And there's a funny story. Years ago, I wanted to do something with Fraise Dubois, which is kind of the original wild strawberry. They're very tiny. They're extremely, extremely fragrant. Very, very delicate. I finally found somebody who would sell them to me, or who had them, and I called him to ask him if he would sell them to me. And he said, well, you know, I do have them, but no, I won't sell them to you. And I said, well, you know, I'm happy to pay for them. And he said, no, I can't sell them to you because they'll never arrive in any kind of shape if I ship them to you. And I said, oh, you know, look, I'll pay whatever the shipping costs to have them overnighted. I'll do, you know, we went through this long negotiation. And finally, I think just to get me off the phone, he said, okay, look, I'm going to ship them to you, but I'm not going to take any responsibility for what they are when they arrive. So the next day, overnighted, I got this huge box. And I opened up the box, and inside of it was, you know, all these packing peanuts. And inside that was another box. So I opened up the other box. It's like one of those Russian dolls. At the very center of it, there was this little, like a pint case. I opened up the pint case, and there was like the most fragrant strawberry jam that I had ever smelled. But even with all of those protective measures, that strawberry could not be shipped. So that's the kind of compromises that have had to be made to ensure that people can have whatever they want, whenever they want it.
So is there a hearty and strong but still tasty strawberry that you recommend?
Not really. I think the best thing that you can say for strawberries is that they're one of the most widely planted crops around. I mean, they're one of the most popular farmers market fruits. And that's generally a pretty good indication of when something has really been ruined by commercial agriculture, is that they really show up at farmers markets. And farmers market farmers have the advantage of being able to plant strawberries that don't need to withstand all of that shipping. You can't really blame the farmers here in California. California produces something like 90% of all of the strawberries, but you can't really blame those farmers because they've got customers all over the country who want their strawberries. And so, you know, either they're going to be like my cranky guy and say, no, I'm sorry, I'm just not going to sell them to you, or they begin making these kinds of compromises. But at farmers markets, the farmers aren't constrained by that, because they're not having to ship it across country or even necessarily across town. So they can grow varieties that have really high flavor and really high perfume and not worry so much about the strawberry jam factor.
Now, in writing about cherries, you refer to the cherry apocalypse. Why? what justifies such a strong term in describing the state of cherries?
Well, what happened with cherries is another one of those kinds of emblematic things. At the turn of the century, New York was a major cherry-producing state. In fact, there's a famous fruit historian named U.P. Hedrick, who I believe it was in the 20s, produced this amazing kind of an Audubon's guide to the cherries of New York. That's actually what it's called, with all these beautiful full-color plates. I think there were 200 varieties of sour cherries alone. But what happened was, New York's a really difficult place to raise fruit because the summers are really hot and they're really humid. And that leads to all kinds of funguses and diseases and breakdowns. The cherry industry, the cherry farmers, eventually moved to the eastern slopes of Washington and Oregon, where the summers are really hot and really dry, and so they ripen much better with much less chance of disease. But in that transition, the possible field of cherries got narrowed. The possible field of cherry varieties got narrowed, to the point where right now the Bing cherry, which actually is an antique variety, and it's a very good cherry when it's grown well, accounts for more than 2/3 of all of the cherries that are grown in the United States. But that's just one variety, as opposed to 300 or 400 different kinds of varieties that have fallen by the wayside.
So if you go to a supermarket and buy cherries, it's most likely you're buying Bing.
If you go to the supermarket and you buy a red cherry, it's a Bing. And if you buy one of those blushing cherries, you know, the kind of golden red ones, it's a Rainier. So we're essentially now a two cherry system.
Now, I feel guilty. I didn't let you talk about tomatoes when I asked you about the food that has suffered most because it's been bred for long distance shipping. And I feel like we should respect the tomato and talk about how it's changed over time for better and for worse. So, I mean, we've all tasted those cardboardy, pulpy, tasteless tomatoes. Have they improved since then, the ones that are shipped?
You know, actually, I think they have. And this is just over the last, maybe even the last 5 years. Tomatoes are almost like a poster child for what can go right with produce. And to illustrate that, you know, think back to maybe 10 years ago. The kinds of tomatoes that you found in the market. You found the mature green, you found a vine ripe, and you probably had cherry tomatoes. So there's like three tomatoes that are in the produce department. This summer, if you walk into any kind of produce department, any kind of upscale, high-end produce department, there will be 25 different kinds of tomatoes that are available for there'll be different varieties of heirlooms, there will be different stages of ripenesses, there will be different colors, different shapes, all different kinds of tomatoes. Now, I'm not going to say that these tomatoes are going to be as good as that backyard tomato that you remember picking from the plant at dead ripeness and eating on your back step. That can't be reproduced very easily in commercial agriculture. You can get those sometimes at farmers markets, but even at farmers markets, not always. The really surprising thing about all of these changes in tomatoes, though, is that this tomato revolution was started by the Dutch and by Canadians. And the thing that really broke that kind of the tomato Antarctic was when the Dutch began importing different varieties of tomatoes into the United States in the early 90s. And people went berserk for them because there were greenhouse tomatoes. They were different varieties. They different shapes. Sometimes they were the tomatoes that grow, you know, that they clip and they sell the entire vine with it. That gives you that really wonderful tomato smell, even if it doesn't translate necessarily to the tomato. And people went crazy for them. And the American tomato growers went into basically almost a decade-long slump trying to recover.
So what changed? Why are there more varieties of mass-grown American tomatoes?
Supermarkets, for all of their faults, are an incredibly competitive industry. I mean, these guys work on like a 1.5% profit margin. And the produce department is one of the main magnets for a supermarket. When people decide which supermarket they're going to go to, it's the produce department often that determines which one they're going to go to. And the produce managers found that, you know, oddly enough, people like having choices. And the funny thing is, when they would offer, you know, 8 or 9 different kinds of tomatoes at the beginning, when they were getting their toes wet, all of those tomatoes might not have sold out, but overall sales of tomatoes increased. So people like going someplace and feeling like they're having choices and that they're being able to, they like to feel like they're seeing exotic things or different things. It builds interest, it builds excitement. And so the produce managers were very quick to jump on the bandwagon.
My guest is Russ Parsons. His new book is called How to Pick a Peach. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. you're just joining us, my guest is Russ Parsons, and he's a food and wine columnist for the LA Times. His new book is called How to Pick a Peach, The Search for Flavor from Farm to Table. Let me ask you about something that I think has gone wrong. I have found that I frequently buy bananas that never ripen. I mean, you can keep them out for however you want, and they'll turn maybe to this kind of like unconvincing shade of yellow, not a full yellow, and, you know,
a reluctant yellow.
Reluctant yellow. Yeah, and like they're just never going to taste good. And at the best, instead of tasting kind of sweet, they'll taste kind of like earthy and a little bitter.
Mm-hmm.
What is going on?
Well, bananas are what botanists call climacteric fruits. And that it's along with tomatoes, with peaches. These are fruits that will continue ripening after they've been picked. But it's important to remember that there's a difference between maturity and ripeness. Maturity is when what happens on the tree, when the plant is gathering all of the nutrients and all of the sugars and all of that stuff that is going to make the building blocks for flavor. Ripeness, it can also happen off of the tree with climacteric fruits. And it's all of those things that turn something from being simply sweet and sour to complex and flavorful. And there's physical softening that is involved in it. And the physical softening leads to the building of more complex flavors and aromas and all of the deliciousness. But if something is picked before it's fully mature, it's never going to ripen to any kind of satisfactory state. And I think that's what's happening with those bananas. They keep pushing them earlier and earlier and earlier. And from the farmer's point of view, you know, being the let's look at both sides of the story kind of guy. From the farmer's point of view, every time a piece of fruit is left hanging on the tree, every day that it's left hanging is an opportunity for something bad to happen. Something good happens because it's developing flavor, but that good thing doesn't quite translate as much to the farmer as the risk of losing a crop because something bad happens. So they keep pushing the harvest earlier and earlier and earlier, hoping that they're, you know, just kind of for safety's sake. And I think that a lot of times they push them to the point where the fruit never ripens to any kind of satisfactory state.
Now, how am I supposed to know which bananas were picked prematurely and will never satisfactorily ripen?
Bananas are really, really hard. I don't think there is a really satisfactory answer for it. And bananas are one of those, the story of the banana is one of those amazing produce legends because bananas don't grow commercially in the United States. But banana is the number one produce item in terms of quantities sold. So it's all of our bananas are imported, most of them from Central America. And, you know, it's probably one of those things that, I hate to say it, but it's probably one of those things that in a perfect world we wouldn't be eating.
Don't say that.
I eat them. I think if you have, you know, if you have consistent bad luck with bananas at one store, it may be time to change stores.
Let's talk a little bit about the world of apples. Now, when I was growing up, I don't know, there was like the Macintosh apple and the Golden Delicious apple and, you know, a couple of other kinds of apples. But now, like, God, there's just like dozens of them. And
there's all these new names. It's like there's this long-running television series, and they've killed off all the regulars, and there's a completely new cast, you know? It sounds like maybe a David Chase series or something like that.
No, there's like the Jonah Gold and the Pink Lady and the Fuji and the Gala. And I mean, I never heard of these growing up.
No. In fact, most of these were introduced from the mid-70s on and even into the 80s. What happened was that the American apple industry, which is mainly in Washington and to a certain extent in Oregon, had really concentrated on a few varieties, primarily Red and Golden Delicious. Red Delicious had been bred to the point where it was no longer delicious. In fact, it was no longer even really acceptable. It's this funny thing. The thing that makes Red Delicious red, the pigment on the skin, also makes it bitter. And so they kept trying to breed the fruit to be redder and redder and redder to try and, you know, because people love to buy red apples. But the redder they got it, the more bitter the apple became. Until finally people just said, the heck with it. You know, this, I'm not eating these anymore. At the same time, they had really pushed to sell fruit in Asia, and they were really not having much success with these varieties. So they started planting test plots of varieties that had been developed in the Southern Hemisphere or in Asia, hence the names like Fuji, and sell, to sell in the Asian markets, because the Asian market has been a huge motivator for produce sales in the last 20 years, because there's so much money to be made there.
So are our Fuji apples now coming from Asia, or have Americans started growing Fuji?
No, they were developed in Asia, and now they planted them in America to sell back to Asia. Well, what they found was that these were actually really good apples, and when they would have extras, they would sell them on the American market, and people were happy to get them. It was a welcome change from the old Red Delicious. Now the Golden Delicious is an old American variety, and that when that's harvested right. That can be a really good apple, but it's important to remember that a Golden Delicious is actually golden. It's not green. Almost all the time you see them green in the market.
You have a lot of advice regarding what kind of foods to refrigerate and what fruit and produce to never refrigerate. What are some of the fruits and vegetables that you should just never refrigerate?
Never refrigerate. I mean, remember the old rhyme, you never refrigerate bananas. Don't put your bananas in the refrigerator. They won't ripen. Potatoes are a weird one. Like if you refrigerate a potato, the enzymes in the potato begin converting the starch to sugar, because it's just the plant getting ready to produce new shoots, and that happens at various rates with different varieties. But if you put a baking potato in the refrigerator for 2 or 3 days, when you bake it, it's got this weird sweet quality to it that's really odd. Probably the single biggest mistake that people make, though, is tomatoes. You should never refrigerate a tomato. Refrigerating a tomato drastically reduces the flavor of the tomato. It'll really ruin it. And at no time should you refrigerate a tomato. I mean, if you've got a tomato that's on the counter and it's ready to turn into that kind of tomato puddle thing, then you've got to refrigerate it, obviously, because otherwise you're going to throw it away. But you have to recognize that you're going to really affect the flavor of it. Peaches are somewhat like that, actually. If you've ever bitten into a peach and it was kind of mealy and dry and it looked great, but there was just no flavor, that's probably chill damage. And it's this very weird thing that happens between like 35 and 45 degrees. They can be kept colder than that and they'll be fine. They can be kept warmer than that and they'll be fine. But if you refrigerate an unripe peach between those two temperatures, it completely ruins the texture and the flavor. So with peaches and nectarines, you want to leave them on the counter until they begin to ripen. You know, that thing of the difference between ripening and maturing, so that they're beginning to soften and they're beginning to smell really good. Then you can put them in the refrigerator and they'll be fine. But if you put them in too early, you're ruining that peach.
Is summer your favorite eating season?
Oh, you know, the thing is, all of them are. So often when people talk about eating seasonally, it's like it's a prescription, or it's a punishment, or it's something that you're doing for the good of the planet, or because, you know, for various ideological reasons. For me, eating with a season is kind of a way of not getting bored. You know, you go from winter with great winter squashes and citrus and greens and cooking greens and that kind of thing. Go to spring with artichokes and strawberries and asparagus. Then to summer with peaches and tomatoes and eggplants and peppers. And you know, in fall, each season has its stars. And part of the fun of eating for me is that kind of part of it is delayed gratification. You know, sometimes you think, oh, I'd really like to have a peach now. You think, well, you know, I could have an adequate peach now, or a barely adequate peach now, or I can have a great piece of citrus, or I can have a great tangerine or grapefruit or something like that. So part of it's when they really come in, they taste so great, it's amazing. But part of it also is that, you know, it's a big wide world that we live in, and especially in produce, and it's full of pleasures, and I think we ought to kind of explore as many of them as possible and not kind of get narrowed down to the two or three things that we really like.
Well, Russ Parsons, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Russ Parsons is the author of the new book, How to Pick a Peach. He's a food and wine columnist for the LA Times. You can read an excerpt of his book on our website, freshair.npr.org. Coming up, Kevin Whitehead reviews the new posthumously released CD by saxophonist Michael Brecker. This is Fresh Air. Jazz musician Michael Brecker passed away in January after a long and public bout with leukemia. Brecker was arguably the most influential saxophonist since the death of John Coltrane 40 years ago, and among the most widely heard modern jazz musicians, owing to pop sessions he recorded with Paul Simon, Joni Mitchell, James Taylor, Yoko Ono, and dozens more. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Brecker's just-released final album.
Michael Brecker's typically tricky composition, Loose Threads. The tenor saxophonist had blossomed in the jazz rock fusion movement of the 1970s, notably with the Brecker Brothers, a band co-led by his trumpeter sibling Randy. Fusion's penchant for complex writing, aggressive rhythms, and a forceful sound stayed with Michael Brecker ever after. On his final album, Pilgrimage, recorded last August, 5 months before his death, his sound is as steely, pitiless, and exacting as ever, even on the quiet ballads. Herbie Hancock on piano. Michael Brecker is one of the most analyzed saxophonists of all time. His solos are the stuff of music school study sessions and dissertations precisely because they're so analyzable, intricately plotted out 5 steps ahead like chess moves. Brecker loved to practice. Even his pretty tunes can sound a little like practice exercises. But his real forte was up-tempo steeplechases where he could show off the fancy stuff he'd figured out and gotten under his fingers. On the album Pilgrimage, he gets plenty of push from a Cracker Jack all-star band. Guitarist Pat Metheny, drummer Jack DeJohnette, bassist John Patitucci, and on this tune, Brad Meldow on piano. Check out the raucous way they back his solo on Anagram. We'll be right back. Michael Brecker's influence on other saxophonists has been huge. You can hear echoes of his style even in such strong and divergent tenors as Norway's ethereal Jan Garbarek and Baltimore's funky Gary Thomas. Brecker has also spawned dozens of outright imitators. They graduate from college jazz programs every year. But Pilgrimage reminds us that the original had it all over the wannabes. This is one posthumous album that needs no special pleading. Michael Brecker sounded strong to the end.
Kevin Whitehead teaches English and American Studies at the University of Kansas, and he's a jazz columnist for eMusic.com. You can download podcasts of our show by going to our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Jenny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Sharuk, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, Jonathan Minhivar, and Joan Tui Westman. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Endless Pools, swimming machines designed for exercise, fitness, and fun. DVD at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. And from the Kauffman Foundation, featuring Good Capitalism, Bad Capitalism, by Will Baumol, Bob Lighton, and Carl Schramm at kauffman.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Jeff Goodell about his book Big Coal, The Dirty Secret Behind America's Energy Future. He says we're more dependent on coal than ever, and the rise of the Internet has only increased the industry's power and influence. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.